The Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome to the Berlin Security Beat Season 3 on all things cybersecurity. Today on Episode 10, we will discuss cyber conflict with Dr. Matthias Schulze, Senior Researcher and Head of the Research Focus International Cybersecurity at the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy at the University of Hamburg. Before his work at IFSH, he was the deputy head of the Security Research Group at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, SWP, as well as the principal investigator in the European Repository of Cyber Incidents Project. Matthias Schulze, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
We're going to talk about cyber conflict more generally today, also a little bit about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Maybe we can begin by providing our audience with some context, building on our previous episode on cyber conflict. Could you give our audience some context on the academic literature and help summarize what you've termed the three Western schools of thought on cyber warfare?
Yeah, sure. Glad to do. So we have been thinking and writing about cyber warfare since at least the early 90s, where this is where things shifted into motion, so to speak. And originally, the thinking was along the lines, okay, we have this new information revolution going on with the internet emerging and so on. And this is going to be a strategic game changer of sorts, right? So this is the first narrative or the first school of thought that strategic cyber warfare is going to be a big thing in the future. And this essentially means that states can project power on a strategic level through cyber operations, so to speak, right? And the idea that is pretty much influenced by the history of the time, right? We have we just came out of the Iraq War with a shock and awe strategy and the technological superiority of the American forces. Then in the mid-90s, you have terrorism coming up, domestic terrorism in the U.S. with the Oklahoma bombings and so forth. And you have a big discussion about critical infrastructure protection that pops up in the U.S. as well. The infamous Y2K bug is popping up, and insecurity about computers is coming into the mainstream. And this influenced the discussion about strategic cyber warfare in the sense that, okay, we have this big infrastructure, the internet, everything is going to be connected to the thing, and this is vulnerable, right? And so the idea emerges that you can shut down an entire nation just with cyber attacks, so to speak. And this is the concept of electronic Pearl Harbor, cyber Pearl Harbor, that was born out of this melange of ideas, so to speak. And yeah, this dominated the thinking in the 90s, and it's appealing, right? You have cyber operations, you have the power grid, you have telecommunication system, they're all connected to the internet. Why not think, okay, if you shut them down, you can cripple an entire modern high-tech nation because you disable the core functionality of electricity and so forth. And from this thinking emerged the idea, we have a disadvantage here, right? They're industrialized nations that are high-tech, have a strategic disadvantage in this scenario because states, for example, like North Korea, who at that time didn't have that much digital infrastructure, would have an advantage because we could not reach them, but they could reach us over the internet at lightning speed, essentially. So this was the idea in the 90s, coupled with terrorism, right? The accommodating concept or accompanying concept of cyber terrorism popped up as well after 9/11, of course. The idea is, oh gosh, it's not just states who could utilize this capability, but also criminal actors or terrorist groups that might hit us where we are vulnerable, particularly critical infrastructure. But this kind of never materialized, right? So it's quite interesting. If you look into the literature on cyber terrorism, it's pretty dominant in the end 90s, mid-2000s. But today, essentially, no one is really talking about this anymore because, well, there are some issues with the concept. Let's frame it like that.
Okay, thank you so much for that. So what about the other two schools of thought about cyber warfare?
Yeah, so as time goes by, we learn stuff, right? This is the essence of science that we learn new things and concepts. And right about the mid-2000s, I would say, a shift started to occur in the thinking that we started to see that this whole strategic narrative, you know, influencing states on the strategic level, altering the balance of power with cyber warfare alone, is not really what's going on here in this domain. And this started to kick in or evolve in military thinking that, okay, maybe we should not think about this capability as a strategic capability that is, you know, designed to project power on a state level, but more it's more like an operational capability in the context of armed operations or armed warfare. And in many militaries around the mid-2000s, the idea kicked in that, okay, the utility of cyber lies in bundling it together with other forces, with conventional forces, right? With the Air Force, with Marines and so forth. So if you look at many first-generation cyber strategies of militaries, you see this idea of joint operations and bundling together cyber plus other types of operations. And in the mid-2000s, there were precedent cases where this materialized, right? There's one famous example where the Israelis used cyber warfare or cyber capabilities to shut down a radar system in Iran and making it essentially blind for incoming aircraft, and then the aircraft is dropping the payload on, I think it was a nuclear research facility or a test reactor of some sort. And this demonstrated how you could do this, right? You can bundle a cyber effect, you know, shutting down a radar system, blinding it, jamming it, whatever, and then you bring in the Air Force. So in sequence, first cyber and second conventional strike. Or the other idea would be to do it in parallel, right? If you have a big offensive going on, and you can read about this in North Korean strategic thinking in terms of battle plan for South Korea, in their military thinking, they would potentially utilize cyber operations in parallel with a conventional invasion. For example, blinding enemy communications networks, trying to slow down military response, trying to introduce friction into command and control system for the military in order for their conventional forces to have better maneuverability, to gain ground more quickly. So, yeah, this is essentially the second school of thought. And then we had another revelation in 2016 where we started to see, well, maybe it's not really about cyber that is so powerful, but what about the information aspect of things, right? And this, again, we all have to see the thinking developing in the context of the time. And in 2016, we had the U.S. presidential election with the election meddling from the Russians. We had Facebook and Cambridge Analytica scandal at the same time. We had the Brexit. And we had in 2014, prior to that, the annexation of Crimea, with the use of disinformation campaigns and false narratives and covert operations. And, you know, this whole fog of war thing that has been spread over the scene in Crimea with the help of cyber and information operations. And then thinking started to shift along the lines, okay, there's something else going on. It's not about cyber per se. It's not about cyber effects shutting down a system or ciphering off intelligence data, but it's about the information aspect or the psychological aspect of cyber operations, right? If you're targeted by a cyber operation, of course, your systems might go down, but it also leaves a psychological imprint on you because you appear vulnerable, you are in chaos, you are in shock, your operations are out running. So there's this whole other psychological dimension that we in the West seem to have missed because we tend to focus on all the technical stuff, right? Technical vulnerabilities, high-tech infrastructure, high-tech military and so forth. We forgot the psychological dimension of it. And the Russians, well, they discovered it and they have written about this in their strategies on information confrontation and information warfare, so to speak, right? The infamous Gerasimov doctrine that is no real doctrine, but outlines the thinking behind that. And here we realized, especially with the annexation of Crimea in 2014, that this is the dichotomy between war and peace, right? We're talking about cyber war. We're not talking about cyber peace, interestingly. But this implies a dichotomy that there's war and peace going on. And this information operations and influence campaigns topic introduced the concept of hybridity, right? There is something in between the two. It's not really war. It's not really peace. Some say it's an unpeace, right? It's not really peaceful and friendly. There's so much going on. But it's something in between on a spectrum, so to speak, between war and peace. And this is where influence operations fall in. And the interesting aspect of this is that the utility of cyber operations in this context is scaled down a little bit, in the sense that this is not a war-fighting capability, but it's a below threshold of war capability, which essentially means that you don't want to escalate into the level of war, but you want to stay below the level of war, because you can reap strategic gains and benefits at this dichotomy, because the Western judicial systems and military thinking and international law thinking is based on the dichotomy between war and peace, right? And if the West will not trigger into war, right, we can maneuver and siphon off data and influence without having to fear repercussions from that. This is what the Russians thought, and then the Chinese as well, somewhat with a different angle. Right, so the idea is we use cyber operations to assert psychological influence, and we use cyber operations for strategic gains in the form of strategic espionage and economic espionage. In the case of China, siphoning of Western intellectual property, and then replicating this at home and building up competitors in the marketplace, whether it's solar technology or steel or fighter jets or whatever, right? So this was the third generation, or is the third generation of thinking, which essentially means it's not about cyber warfare per se, it's about the bigger thing, the information aspect of it. And yeah, this you could argue in a nutshell, and maybe the Ukraine war just ushered in the fourth generation of thinking, but we'll have to see about that.
Okay, thank you so much for that. It is definitely interesting to see the hybrid psychological and information operations dimension of cyber as a tool for sub-threshold operations. I'd like to talk more now about the military element. You have talked extensively about cyber and warfare in your research. How do you assess, to borrow from one of your research papers, the strategic, tactical, and operational utility of military cyber operations?
So maybe we start with an introduction what this strategic, operational, and tactical level means. This is coming from the military thinking on the three levels of warfare, right? There's the strategic layer, the operational layer, and the tactical layer. And the strategic layer is essentially what the generals in the headquarters are seeing, right? They see their troops spread over a big world map. They have their little tiny ships on the map, right? And planes and aircraft and resources and logistic depots and stuff like that. This is the strategic level. The operational level is the level of an invasion campaign, for example. A good example is the D-Day campaign in Second World War, right? The invasion of Normandy from over the English Channel. This is the operational level, the unfolding of a sequence of battles in a shorter period of time. And then at the lowest level, you have the tactical level, and this is the level of actual fighting, the trenches, the MG nests shooting, the landing boats dropping off soldiers and stuff like that, right? And all these levels are, of course, intertwined. And this concept of the three levels of warfare was introduced to differentiate what is going on a little bit. So we're talking about warfare here. We're talking about how to use cyber in a context of an armed conflict, which is, of course, something different compared to when we talk about cyber in a non-conventional conflict world, right? So these three levels will play out differently whether we are in war or in peace. So the strategic utility of cyber, as was envisioned in the thinking of the 1990s and so on, is this idea you can shut down an entire nation with a cyber attack, essentially, right? It's a standalone capacity. You don't need armed forces anymore. You just can cripple, pardon my words, an entire modern infrastructure with cyber operations. Or the other concept on the strategic level is, because there are some issues with this strategic thinking, because it's not so easy, right? So the theory is one thing, but the practice of cyber operations says something else. So maybe it's not just this strategic effect, but there are other strategic effects that you can see with cyber operations as well. And one of those are influence operations and psychological operations, right? Turning a target audience towards something or against something, enraging it, distracting it, exerting pressure on political parties or political actors, discrediting them, influencing referenda or elections outcomes in case of Brexit and Trump election 2016, trying to discredit political candidates and stuff like that. So this is a strategic effect because it can potentially alter the balance of power, right? The idea is simple. If we are in our democratic discourses are constantly distracted and constantly infighting because we are driven by anger and aggression on our social media platforms, by influence campaigns, we are distracted from the world politics that's going on out there. Yes, and influence operations or information operations essentially means you push out narratives like in traditional propaganda that you try to convince a target audience of or shape their perception of things. And in Ukraine 2014, it worked for the Russians because we weren't invested in that. Many Western politicians didn't believe that Ukraine was part of Europe or that some thought, that, well, it's historically part of Russia, right, which is one of the influence campaign narratives that we see today in the context of the war in Ukraine. It was one of the key strategic narratives of official propaganda channels of the Russian government, but also of unofficial or black propaganda channels. And so we could see how this played out in 2014, that this is this produces a strategic effect because if you can co-opt a country, so to speak, or occupy a country, you can increase your resources and your resources of power. Another utility of cyber operations and influence operation is communication, essentially, right? So every cyber operation communicates something. And we have seen states using cyber operations for means of communications and also as an alternative way of exerting power and influence, right? In many situations, if you consider the tools of power that states have, they can use the military, they can use diplomacy, they can use money, they can summon meetings, soft power, and some along these lines. But they also, and sometimes they use special forces to do something, right, extract hostages in some sort, or use limited military engagements to reach their goals. And cyber operations are one arrow in the quiver, so to speak, or on the bow. That you could use as an alternative. And for example, we've seen this playing out between Iran and Israel, that if Iran does something or if Israel does something, then Iran responds with a cyber operation just to signal, okay, we see what's going on. This is retaliation for what you just did. But we don't want to escalate physically anymore. That's why we use cyber operations to send you a message, essentially, right? And you can see this sort of signaling behavior all along the lines, and even there are some deeper messages embedded in some of these operations that are only visible to the people doing the forensics and the intelligence agencies that are tasked with analyzing these incidents, that you can see, okay, this was designed to deliver a message because the operation was calibrated in a way signaling we could have done much more, but we didn't, and you got the message, right? So strategic communication is also one aspect. And of course, what the Chinese are doing, siphoning off intelligence and economic, doing economic espionage and stealing intellectual properties, patents, designs, CAD designs for manufacturing, and then, you know, devising a political strategy to become world leader in many of the technological domains that we depend on and that drive the current generation of technology. This is also some aspect of strategic power being used with cyber operations or espionage in this case, most certainly. And of course, the last point you can argue is that the authoritarian states tend, or many think that the authoritarian states have some sort of advantage in this domain because A, they are not that digitized as the Western countries are. B, they have tighter control over their information space, both technically also, but also on the information domain, because they have stricter censorship rules. They can limit what people say on internet fora and on social media platforms, and they have tighter surveillance in place to monitor what's going on in their domestic intranet. So they have some defensive advantage, you could say. They are not as exposed and vulnerable and open as the Western democratic discourses and internet infrastructure as well, because China and Russia and also Iran and other states, they start to build up filtering systems to shield off their domestic intranet or internet from the rest of the internet. And this makes it a little bit harder to reach into that.
Yes, yes. Let me just say how interesting I find it that cyber has become a tool that increases the space for movement and operation for different states. And also, I find it very interesting how it's intricately related to escalation management, or rather, the ability of states to operate without necessarily escalating or causing escalation. So could you expand a little more about the operational utility aspect, please?
Sure. Just one word on the escalation topic, because I studied this a little bit as well. So many people in the West fear that if we go on the offensive in cyberspace, right, doing hackbacks, as we call it in Germany, this might escalate something, right? But the literature is pretty, well, not certain, but there's solid evidence there that cyber can also be used for de-escalation as well, because it is an alternative to conventional force. So it's not the trajectory is not outright clear that more cyber leads to more escalation. It could also be the other way around, just to throw this note here. In terms of operational utilities, on the operational level, unfolding campaigns using cyber in conjunction with conventional operations or kinetic operations, we've seen a lot of things going on this layer as well. And the most important, I think, is intelligence preparation of the battlefield. So not cyber operations to disrupt something, but cyber operations to gather data. This is what they've been primarily used in many conflicts or the later conflicts, whether it's Ukraine or previous ones, that you try to gather intelligence that you can use to know where enemy positions are, to know where enemy troop movements are, what type of troops are in a region, how they are communicating, over what channels, what does their command and control structure look like, and these sort of things. So to support traditional kinetic military war planning, so this is certainly a topic that is relevant. The other big topic in terms of operations support is logistic. The Americans and in the West, we are pretty much aware that the Achilles heel of NATO in Europe is logistics, right? Moving troops across the Atlantic in time to Europe and across Europe over the railway system, over the autobahn system and so forth, the motorway system, bringing it to the location where they are needed. And much of this relies on private contractors, right? Whether it's Deutsche Bahn or FedEx and even UPS. I heard that the U.S. military uses UPS, so which are private companies, right? So if you can, shut down the logistics booking system of UPS, and you would slow down logistics of the U.S. armed forces to a certain degree, or communication satellites. Western forces, NATO, U.S. forces, they rely on satellite communication for all kinds of things, command and control, whether it's managing the drones, right? The data feeds go to satellites and then go back to a headquarters somewhere, or any other targeted precision strike capability, cruise missiles, artillery, and so forth. They use satellite data as well. And if you would hack a satellite, and you can, because there's ample evidence on numerous hacker conferences around the world that satellites are vulnerable to hacking because they use rather old-fashioned hardware and software. They are in space for really long times, 15, 20 years sometimes. So if you have a satellite up there that is 20-year-old, that is hardware from the early 2000s, maybe running on Windows XP. Well, not really, but you get the idea. And this is, of course, not patched and vulnerable to hacking. So satellites are a big problem. But also traditional railway systems. There is some speculation, I'm not really sure whether this is true, where hacktivists claimed within the context of the invasion of Ukraine in 2022 that they hacked the Belarusian railway system in order to slow down deployment of troops from the Belarusian borderline, where the Russians have troops positioned there. So we're not really sure whether the delay happened. There were some issues there, but whether it was physical sabotage of tracks or cables or something, or cyber operations, we don't know, but something happened. And you can think about any other things like oil pipelines, for example, as well, which are relevant. Communication links, making it harder to know what's going on in a region or on a battlefield because communications are not working. So these are some utilities of cyber operations on the operational level.
Let me just jump in there for a short comment. I think you bring a very interesting point here, and that is the dual use nature of most cyber, because digital systems cross all different boundaries, and so much of how our society functions now is between the public and private sector, and so the attack surface across our societies is really quite large. As you say, our governments rely so much on private actors who use different systems that could be more vulnerable or not properly designed or aligned. So that's something I definitely wanted to highlight before we move on to the tactical aspect.
And it's really hard to secure as well, because a lot of the infrastructure is in private hands, which makes governance and management and security way harder, right? Yeah. Okay, so last point, tactical level. So this is essentially the idea that you have troops on the ground and they carry some sort of electronic equipment with them that allows them to hack on the front line, right? So this is a theoretical concept. There is not that much not that much practical use here, because there are some severe restrictions when it comes to cyber operations on a close quarter combat kind of situation, right? So the Americans thought about this a little bit, how to utilize cyber operations in this context. And they came up with the idea, well, it might be useful in the context of urban warfare. So it pretty much depends on the type of war you're fighting, right? If you are, for example, in Afghanistan, where there's open fields, little internet connectivity, then, of course, you have a limited utility for cyber operations. If there's nothing to hack, you cannot hack anything. So utility differs. But if you have an urban environment, we know where there's internet coverage, where you have maybe internet-connected cameras, IoT devices that control doors, for example, or water pumps and so, along these lines, you can use this knowledge, for example, that you gain from hacking into a camera feed of an internet-connected camera. There are plenty of them out there. Many of them report back to a cloud somewhere, so you can potentially tap into this data feed, see what's going on in a surveillance camera in a building, and give this information to your special forces unit on the ground that is doing the infiltration in this building, for example. This is what the Israelis feared about when they engaged Hamas, that they advised to shut down cameras, that because this might give out intelligence of ground movements and along these lines. Yeah, but the problem with that is it's timing and having it in position and in time when you need it, because hacking normally requires a little bit of time, a little bit of preparation, and having this data available and bringing it to the troops that are currently in fighting in a combat engagement is really complicated and really hard, because you cannot pack a cyber attack kit onto a backpack of a soldier like you can, for example, an anti-IED device that is able to detect electronic explosive devices, something like that. So in terms of tactical utility on the battlefield, it's more theory than practicality to the present day.
Okay, thank you for that. I wonder if we can speak a little bit more about these attempts to combine cyber and conventional warfare. Can you elaborate on the difficulties of joint cyber and conventional warfare? Thank you.
Okay, so it essentially boils down to the problem that cyber is not an all-purpose sword, as some people call it, right? The North Korean leader once allegedly said that cyber is an all-purpose sword usable for all kinds of things. But it depends, right? And one of the issues with cyber operations is that it's in stark contrast to conventional weaponry, that cyber operations have to be tailored to the target you're attacking. So a cyber attack is a combination of a vulnerability that exists in a system, and your technical means to exploit this vulnerability deliver a payload, a piece of software essentially, to that system and taking it over, and then controlling it from afar. So there are a lot of requirements for this, right? You need to have a vulnerability in a system. It's hard to get systems that are not connected to the internet, right? But they might play an important role. So if there's no connectivity, it makes things a lot harder. And then you have to deliver the payload somehow, right? And this often happens either via email, old school phishing emails that deliver a malware attachment or a link that people need to click on. And then they have another obstacle here. People need to actually click on this thing. And if people are educated and have cyber awareness training, they might not do that. And then you need to install that malware. Then you have the next hurdle. So it's really complicated to do all this. And this is a stark contrast to conventional weaponry. If you have an artillery shell, for example, or a cruise missile, you know, okay, you have the payload, which is explosives, you can calculate how big the damage is likely going to be depending on what type of target you hit. But you know, you're pretty sure that it makes boom when you hit a tank or whatever with an artillery shell. And you can be pretty sure about the effect. Of course, you can miss, but it's pretty certain then if you have this kind of shell and this type of tank, in 99% of cases, the tank is destroyed, right? With cyber operations, this is not really the case, right? There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of tailoring requirements. So this essentially means to tailor a malware to a system means you tailor it to one system, but you cannot necessarily use it against another system as well, right? If this one target machine is running Windows, you need to have a malware available for Windows. If the next computer you're trying to attack with the type of operation runs Linux, you need a payload for Linux, right? So you have to adapt your attack to what you find on a system, what type of software is running there, what type of vulnerabilities are running on this system or are present on this system, what type of anti-malware solutions are running on the system, and what type of defensive lines are present in this environment, right? And this takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of reconnaissance. So in cyber security, there's this concept of kill chain, which essentially means the steps that an attacker has to walk through in order to reach its desired effects, and there are multiple steps involved. And one of the early steps is reconnaissance, right? You need to scout the system you're trying to attack. You need to conduct vulnerability scanning, port scanning. Need to run operating system enumeration, what software is running, if you have a vulnerability there. You need to figure out maybe the social engineering angle. Who are the administrators? Where are they living? Can I find their email addresses on social media platforms to send them a phishing email? So this type of reconnaissance, scouting the attack surface, so to speak, takes a lot of time and preparation. Then you have to deliver the payload to the target system either via email or via a vulnerability in a web service of some sort. You have to install the payload, execute it undetected, right? If you have anti-malware solution running on a system, it might spring up an alert. Or there might be, if you have more capable defenders, they might have a security team waiting for you. They might have set up traps, a honey net or a honeypot system that tricks you into believing it's a valuable target, but it's not really. So a lot of things can go wrong with delivering a malware. Of course, in the media, we always focus on the negative cases where something went wrong, but there are a lot of positive cases that we just don't see because they never made the headlines. So attacks fail often, and attacks often require multiple iterations until they work. So all this process I just was describing takes a lot of time. There are operational cycles, right? If one attack fails, you have to start anew, go back to the scratch book, write a new malware, deliver it again, blah, 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 takes time again. So these cycles, delivering a malware and so on, and combining this with conventional operations planning is really complicated and really, really hard to do because you have different speeds that you're operating with, and different tempo. And another aspect with cyber operations is that you need a lot of lead time. So you need to be in place before your conventional operation starts because of the reconnaissance requirement and so forth. So this is why many countries that are on the offensive have this idea of pre-positioning. So they enter critical infrastructure networks before something conventional or escalation happens or a crisis happens, because they need the time in advance to scout the system and analyze it. And then in case of an escalation or a conflict or an attack, they can execute a payload there. So this is pre-positioning, and it must happen before your conventional invasion. And the Russians in Ukraine, they did exactly this. They were present in Ukrainian networks way before 2022. Around summer 2021, we started to see pre-positioning attempts in various Ukrainian critical infrastructures because of that reason, because it takes time.
I mean, I just want to add on to pre-positioning. We saw a lot of pre-positioning attempts, but we did not see such strong effects, did we?
You have done this well, right? You have repositioned yourself, you're ready to go, we have your conventional battle plan in place, you know where to move which troops. You're pretty certain that if you strike this facility, let's say it's a command and control system for, I don't know, satellite navigation, right? Like in the Ukrainian war with the Viasat hack. You are in place, you have your troops ready, and then you hit enter and you send the malware and the system goes down. Great, great, great. You achieved your effect. You move in your troops and you maybe have a short-term advantage. Okay, this is the best case scenario of this, if you achieve your desired effect. But now the things get tricky. What if the system recovers quickly, right? If the defenders are good, if they have a security team in place, they have done their homework, they have an incident response plan, they have a strategy, they have people, they have trained this, and they're back running online 1 hour later, right? But you still rely on this communication system being down. but now it's back up again. So it starts to get tricky, right? So the certainty of effects is a little bit challenging in the cyber domain, because effects can be reversible in many instances, unless you could do physical damage with a cyber operation. But if you do just digital damage, disruption, slowing down a service, encrypting data, deleting a system, and so on, this is potentially irreversible. So this introduces uncertainty. And of course, there can be defensive measures like honey networks and deception devices that trick you into believing, well, you pre-positioned, we're ready to go. But in reality, you are not, because you're just sitting in a phony network, so to speak. And one last point is vulnerability stockpiles. As I mentioned, you need a vulnerability in many cases to enter a system via unauthorized access. Could be a human vulnerability in terms of phishing, could be a technical vulnerability. If you run out of vulnerabilities, much like you can run out of artillery shells, you cannot conduct new operations because you have to build new malware and utilize new vulnerabilities. So it's potentially possible that you run out of malware, so to speak, if you burn it too quickly. If you launch too many offenses, too many cyber campaigns, the defender discovers what you're doing, reports this information back to the software vendor, the vulnerabilities get fixed, and then your attack does not work anymore. And if you don't have more vulnerabilities in stockpile, you cannot launch more campaigns. And there were some indications that the Russians ran out of vulnerabilities in summer 2022, and their operational tempo slowed down much more, because it's a possibility, right? You cannot prove it, that they run out of vulnerabilities and malware. And afterwards, they reshaped their approach and used other types of attacks to compensate for this. So, this is, in a nutshell, the challenges of combining sub-operations and operational forces. And we've seen in Ukraine that it's quite hard to do.
I want to ask a quick follow-up. Are you aware of any cyber operations that have done physical damage to infrastructure? Of course, the most famous example is Stuxnet damaging Iranian nuclear centrifuges. But could you share another example?
Yes, there are a few, but it's just a few handful, not even a few, maybe just two handful. Yeah, so it depends a little bit on what you're talking about. The first test scenario where this was used was the Aurora test generator in 2008, where the Americans used software to destroy a generator in a test environment, right? So it was a controlled environment. And from this conceptualization, they developed the Operation Olympic Games, aka the Stuxnet and Dooku campaign, to target Iranian nuclear enrichment facilities and to physically damage nuclear centrifuges by making them spin too fast and then breaking the joints and the connecting systems. The Russians tried to shut down the power in Ukraine in 2016, and with Indestroyer malware. And this is the other big case where physical effect occurred, or a bigger physical effect occurred because of a cyber operation. And I think, but I'm not pretty 100% certain, that they overloaded a general as well. But don't nail me down on that. But of course, cyber operations have physical effects, even if you don't destroy something, right? For example, what the Russians did with NotPetya in 2017, so they had this worm, right? A worm is a software that is able to crawl from one system to another, or a network device, or the internet. And they bundled on it a ransomware called Petya, or that looked like the ransomware Petya, but it was not Petya. That's why the name came about, to encrypt systems and making them unusable. And they encrypted the domain controller of the company Maersk, a big shipping container logistics company, and they shredded an entire network of the company, and so they had to stop operating their entire port business, right, for a couple of weeks. So port operations stopped, and if port operations stop, well, things rot in the containers, so they go bad, you produce traffic jams and all sorts of shenanigans. So even if you don't have physical destruction, which again is really hard to produce but possible, the temporary disruptions and delays and other type of effects can be relevant as well, especially if you bundle multiple of them together.
Let's zoom out for a second, and I want to look at the global scale. My question is about the ethics of cyber warfare, of cyber conflict. What ethical dilemmas arise when nations engage in cyber operations, particularly as it's relevant to democracies, and how are they being addressed, both by states, but also in the international domain?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. and a difficult one. So, as in all wars, you have the question whether to target civilian infrastructure or not, right? If you're not in wartime, it's a no-go. But if you are in a conflict war scenario, targeting civilian infrastructure, if it is used for military purposes, is legitimate under international humanitarian law. So, since most of the infrastructure is in private hands in cyberspace, you necessarily need to target civilian infrastructure in war if you want to achieve your aims. So, and this implies that you have collateral damage, that you might have cascading effects, that something spirals out of control, that civilian services are no longer running. And depending on the service, this might be really bad, whether it's hospitals, for example, or water supply, or electricity, or transport. So one of the challenges is that because the modern technical infrastructure is so intertwined and interconnected, you don't really know what happens if you take one brick out of the Jenga tower, right? The whole thing might collapse, but it might not. It's just because it's so tightly knit together. And there's always the damage of collateral effects or the risk of collateral effects, which you need to mitigate. If you're an offensive operator, you need to be aware of potential collateral damage effects. And this is quite interesting. The British, they just a while ago published a document called Responsible Offense or Responsible Cyber Offense, where they outline some ethical principles that their cyber operations shall have in order to minimize collateral damage, in order to minimize unwanted consequences. So they make the case that they need to tailor their operations to specific targets. This implies that you might not maybe want to do a worm component in your attack that automatically crawls through systems, because it's really hard to control a worm, as the Americans have seen with Stuxnet, which was discovered because it moved to systems where it was not supposed to move to. It means making some sort of battle damage assessment beforehand, so estimating what might happen if we shut down a system or if we impact this service, who might be dependent on this service. So all these sorts of considerations need to flow in. Also, you know, judicial categories, whether this is right or wrong, whether sovereignty is affected of another country, all these questions need to flow into these considerations, whether to hack or not. Another interesting ethical dilemma is the use of vulnerabilities, right? So there's this big debate going on between the cybersecurity community, the more technical cybersecurity community, and the corporations and defensive security companies, and the more offensive aligned actors in the intelligence agencies and the military. Because cyber operations require vulnerabilities, and the question now becomes, what do you do with those vulnerabilities that are really high impact, that are unknown to a company, which you essentially can exploit without anyone noticing, because the knowledge about the vulnerability is not yet published, the so-called zero-day vulnerability. And of course, the offensive actors argue, well, these zero-day vulnerabilities, they are super, super useful. They are the skeleton keys, so to speak. You can break into a system without the adversary noting it, and they give you a lot of value, intelligence value, for example, because you can sit on a system for a long time without being noticed, which is super useful for intelligence actors. But the technical people and the IT security people argue, well, every vulnerability is a vulnerability and needs to be fixed, right? Because who says that it's, well, it might be you that have the knowledge about the vulnerability, but do you know that the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranian, and North Koreans have the knowledge of the same vulnerability and sitting on systems on our end of the game, and we are not able to detect them? So if we would have the knowledge about the vulnerability, we would be able to defend ourselves better. So this is this interesting ethical dilemma around vulnerability disclosure. Is it better to inform the vendor of a product about the vulnerability, or do we maintain the knowledge secret or keep it secret and exploit it for offensive purposes? And I tend to lean along the lines of the IT security people, because we have so many vulnerabilities out there, and vulnerabilities are one of the biggest problems in cybersecurity, and we need to fix that because there are just so many, and we can't get ahead of the problem, so to speak.
My final question, and we're staying on the global scale. In what ways do you think that the cyber warfare that we're seeing in Ukraine, but also more broadly, is affecting global cybersecurity practices and policies? What are the major trends that you're seeing emerge now?
Another good question. So many countries that were purely on the defensive side of IT security, cybersecurity, they are now starting to consider offensive operations as well. So this is certainly one trend that was initiated by the war in Ukraine. So we have countries like, for example, Japan. Japan is formerly a super defensive country, has a similar historical context as Germany with being after the Second World War, purely defensive, you know, small military, culture of restraint. And they are now thinking about building up a cyber command, a military cyber command with 4,000 people in it, also with an offensive mandate, because they think the security environment changed after Ukraine, with particularly with quite aggressive Chinese cyber operations in the region, in the Southeast Asian region. And so they're now thinking about offense, which was unheard of before. And also smaller European countries, for example, like Sweden and Finland, who just joined NATO, they were more on the defensive side of things as well, and they are now thinking about offensive strategies as well. Also, you have countries like France, for example, who are beefing up their cyber command with new positions, up to 4,000 soldiers in 2027 or something like that. It's the goal. I don't know if they can achieve that, but it's a goal. And countries like Poland and so on, they are investing heavily in offense. So this is certainly one trend in terms of policy. Also, you can see discussions in within the EU and within NATO how to respond to cyber operations collectively. So we have within the European Union, we have this whole concept of cyber diplomacy or cyber diplomacy toolbox, which includes certain measures that you can do after cyber operations, how holding bilateral consultations, for example, bringing in the ambassador, also, you know, initiating travel bans and asset freezes and something along those lines. And there's, to be honest, there's little evidence that these things are seem to be working, right? We have so many cyber operations out there. And of course, we have asset freezes against Russian hackers and against Chinese hackers and North Korean hackers. But it's not deterring them in any way. They're still going on because the benefit of hacking and the strategic benefit of cyber operations is way bigger than the consequences that they have to fear in terms of diplomatic sanctions and so on. So there's a lot of thinking going on, okay, what can we do or what more can we do to respond to the problem, particularly against below-threshold operations that don't necessarily trigger NATO Article 5 because they are not a conventional attack, they don't cause physical damage, or the EU solidarity clause on the European level, because the majority of cyber operations, even the big names like WannaCry or NotPetya or Stuxnet, they rarely scratch the threshold of an armed attack, which would justify a military response. So there's a lot of thinking about what to do here, and it's not easy. It's hard.
Well, Matthias Schulze, thank you so much for appearing on our podcast.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Berlin Security Beat of the Center for International Security at the Hertie School. Please stay tuned for more episodes. They'll be coming in the next couple of months. We still have some great content for you about cyber diplomacy and much, much more. If you're interested in a master's in international affairs with an international security focus, please check out the Hertie School, and don't forget to subscribe and follow the Center for International Security on all our channels. This is Dave Bukowski from Berlin.